the generator has, let's see, harmonics greater than minus 25 dBc, non-harmonics greater than minus 40 dBc, typically minus 60 dBc, in band typical greater than minus 70 dBc. The only other specification that generator has is SSB noise 90 dBc per hertz at plus or minus 20 kilohertz from carrier.
Yeah, that last one is a spectral purity measurement. In other words, the amount of residual FM or phase modulation. That's a good setting. That's a good number. 25 dB of harmonic rejection. Not great, but it may be good enough in your environment. In your particular environment, I'd like to believe your RF amplifier would not respond to the second harmonic. Although it might. If you think the second harmonic is giving you grief, you could repeat the test on another channel. If the radio had more than one channel to it. In other words, go to another channel of reception and repeat the test. Probably this is a crystal-controlled rig on one particular channel, and you don't have that freedom. You can also experiment by using a second signal generator, another brand name of signal generator, to see if you come up with the same reading. Another thing you can do is you can build a bandpass filter. Build or use or install low-pass, bandpass, filter, which rejects the harmonics from your signal generator. If you think that that's an aggravating factor, that one's not too difficult to eliminate. You probably have a bandpass filter already when it comes to other auxiliary hardware. Like, for instance, if this is a 450 megacycle repeater, and you're heavily into the repeater business, you probably own a couple of extra 450 megacycle cavities you can plug in. Just one more plugging in would be rejecting the harmonics out of the signal generator by a zillion dB and see if it makes a difference when you repeat the test. So, you're measuring 50 and the specification of the receiver is 85, but it doesn't say at what level for the on-channel signal. It's hard for me to believe that something suddenly degraded in your radio to make your 85 become 50. Unless somebody went in there with a tuning screw, a tuning tool, and stagger-tuned your IF cans, which I think is unlikely, but if it did, you can always check the alignment of the IF strip. The vast majority of the adjacent channel rejection is coming from the IF can alignment. That's the only thing that's got enough selectivity to really reject something only 25 kCOA. Your roofing filter, your RF amplifier, it can't even touch that. It doesn't have anywhere near that kind of bandwidth. So the only thing you got left to test is the alignment of your IF strip, as I see it, Joe. So the A2RY1, K2RYW.
Yeah,
Doug,
can I ask this, Dick? Can I ask him a question?
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, Dick just stated, I pushed the button, I heard him say that. The tuned transformers for the components, that most likely in the filter circuit, they may have a tuned transformer. I once ran into something distant but similar in the selectivity, loss of selectivity. And what was wrong, there was a shorter turn developed in one of the tuned transformers. And boy, that sure knocked the heck out of the selectivity stick over.
How did you confirm that shorter turn, Mel? Much lower than normal gain at that particular stage?
Well, right away I suspected because, you know, right away there was a loss of selectivity, but there was also, the signals were, you know, just not what they used to be. It was like, you know, you can't really, accept it. Of course, I had another one to compare it with. Basically, what I had to do is really, I had to go into to determine, you know, really where it was. You know, it's a pain in the neck to pick that out, which exact transformer. So the only way I was able, I remember, to find the problem was I did a test of the bandwidth and an insertion loss measurement of the filter's performance. That's what I did. I remember that now. I think it's a number of years ago, but I remember the procedure now. Over.
Yeah, an IF can with a shorted turn can be a real dog of a problem. Of all the television sets that I ever repaired in my early years, and I worked my way through college repairing television sets, I once ran into one where it intermittently would short the IF can only when the set got warm. And to find that was fairly difficult for me. Nowadays, I would have just gone down the strip with the a good spectrum analyzer or a very fast oscilloscope and say, hey, the signal is here up to that point, and it's not getting beyond that point, what's in between? But I wasn't that skilled with signal injection techniques and signal tracing techniques in those days. I was using much more crude techniques, and that was a real tough one to find. So it's a slim possibility that's what you're running into, Joe. I would try to get another copy of that radio, another serial number, to see if it behaves the same way. If so, you're talking about a manufacturing design problem as opposed to a failure of your particular serial number that's in your hand. For the E2RY1, K2RYW in the tech net.
Well, I think another receiver would probably perform similarly. I mean, I certainly have another receiver strip available to test, perform the test on. And as far as the IF goes, I've checked the IF band shape using an RF detector probe and a sweep function of a generator. It is symmetrical. The high IF, which is at 12.4 megahertz, is not adjustable. The low IF at 455 is adjustable.
That's the thing you've got to look at, Dick.
Now, in other words, yeah, the high IF is a fixed set of ceramic filters, most likely. What are you saying, Mel?
Okay, in the mixer, is occasionally what they were doing is some of the more modern ones that had the loss of selectivity. They use pin diodes and attenuated, and that is worked basically as AGC control. It's basically, I'm trying to remember how they arranged it in the mixer, so it'll come back to me. But I had once, I think, that there was a question with the pin diode and RF attenuated, which were basically AGC controlled, and that was also a member for affected the selectivity. And I got to say, this is years ago when I was doing troubleshooting. These were mostly doing troubleshooting. These were mostly used as aircraft, FM aircraft system, with the using the Omni. You know, the Omni system for navigation, Dick, over.
Yeah, by Omni, I think you mean VOR, VHF, Omnidirectional Direction Finding and Ranging, the VOR station. And there I would guess that you'd really like to have a nice alignment of that IF strip. Okay, Joe, as you further investigate this problem, and when you make any discoveries, please come back and tell us what you find. Because for all of us, this is a learning experience, and you're fairly deep now into specificity testing of a particular radio. You have reason to believe that 50 dB of rejection, what you would like to be 85, do you think it's going to give you a grief? Because where the adjacent channels of FM allocation these days for a repeater service are reversing high in, low out, and vice versa, or high out, low in, and they're reversing that, do you believe there's going to be a nearby transmitter, 25 KC away, in your particular circumstance? Back to you, Joe.
I don't believe there's going to be. I know there is, and that's why I was performing these particular tests. It seems like this guy, he's running similar equipment like what I'm running, and the change happened to be noticed when he changed the antennas on his site, and he's getting about a good 6 to 7 dB more performance in combination of changing the antenna and the feed line over the antenna he had before. Apparently, that's enough to throw the receiver he has as a repeater receiver a little bit more over the edge as far as not being able to reject me.
That offending transmitter to you is located what distance away from your antenna, Joe?
Oh, I would say approximately seven, maybe 8 miles line of sight, something like that.
Okay, thank goodness. I was a little bit afraid that it's on top of the same building with you. That would be a very difficult situation to live with. The amount of attenuation you get from 7 or 8 miles in decibels is, well, something like 100 dB. That helps an awful lot. You could build a notch filter on that 25 kc adjacent channel. And whether you place that notch filter in your 455 kc IF, whether you place it in your 10 meg IF, or whether you try to make a very sharp notch filter and place it at the antenna, there's a whole lot of advantages and disadvantages of each individual location. But when you've got a very specific signal that can give you grief, and therefore you want a very specific notch in your overall response at that frequency, there are ways you can make a modification to do that. At 455 KC, to create a notch 25 KC away would be relatively easy, assuming that everything up to that point is running linear and not being saturated by that signal. You have to do a little bit of testing ahead of time to make sure that as that signal comes through your RF amplifier, mixer, first IF, second mixer, and then into the second IF, make sure everything up to that point is not being saturated. Otherwise, the notch filter is not going to do much. But if you can confirm you've got enough linearity that nothing's being saturated to that point, then for you to add a notch filter could give you, I'll bet you, another 25 dB of performance improvement. Back to you, Joe.
One more comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Bill.
You brought up a good point. ZillaConnect makes a filter that is really great. It's for cross-modulation intermodulation filter, which they call is basically crunch-proof. So you can look into that. They get all kinds of selection of them. And they are extremely effective, Dick, over.
Now, the kind of filter you're talking about, Mel, does it go into the RF, first IF, or the second IF? Go ahead.
What does it go into? Let me remember what it was. It was, I think, well, they have, let me put it this way, there was a number of them. One of them is goes into, is used in the mixer, if I remember correctly. Yeah, it was in the mixer. They had one. And I remember that was gave you a control range of around 60 dB. That was their target range on that. And then they had, that's what they called it, the crunch-proof mixer. The crunch-proof mixer, Dick. And then they had one that actually has actually works by PIN diode and attenuating system that goes in the front end there, before the IF, if I remember correctly. I know they had a whole bunch of them that they were listing. ZillaConnect specializes in those type of filters. Over.
I do know of a company called Siliconic. Is that the one you're mentioning, Mel?
I think they call it Siliconic or ZillaConnect. Yeah, most likely I'm pronouncing it wrong. I like to change everything. from California, Palo Alto, I think, Dick.
Sounds like Siliconic. You got to put the emphasis on the right syllable. Okay. Looks to me like you've got a number of solutions here, Joe, and a number of tests, but a number of solutions. And when you do find one that works for you, let us know about it. Thank you for any final comments, Joe.
VB2HWW with a comment on the subject.
How we recognize that. Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, the offending transmitter, which is mine to his repeater, it's actually bought, you know, goes both particular ways. But he seems to be getting a little more crunch than I'm getting crunched. my signal coming into his repeater, from his repeater antenna into his cabinet, is minus 46 dBm.
Yeah, that's rather potent. For a system that normally receives signals of minus 110, minus 46 dBm is what, 70 dB above threshold, and that's starting to get serious. Howie, what would you do in a case like this?
There's no solution, because as you deviate, as you swing the carrier either side, it's going to get close. Say you got 5 cases of deviation, and you take your modulation index of 1.6. That means as you swing, you're going to come to within 8 kc. You're going to come 8 kc down, so 25 minus 8 is whatever, 2015, about, you're going to come about 17. You're going to come very close and come within the bandpass of the other receiver. So there's almost no solution to that, Dick. Go ahead.
What you're describing is a very difficult situation, particularly if the offending repeater happens to have very loud audio and over-deviates, with or without distortion, because he's banging into the IF strip that's on his transmitter. That could make life kind of difficult. Yep. I think you're telling me, Joe, that if you had your druthers, you would go to the, I guess it used to be called TSOC, Tri-State Repeater Council, now it's called Metro something or other. I guess you would tell them, go very slow with these assignments for odd and even channels. Not only select odd and even, but be very careful in selection of the geography. Very similar to what happens in the broadcast world. Until very recently, you'll notice that adjacent channels are not assigned to a single area. New York City, for instance, has channels 2, 4, 5. 4 and 5 looks like they're one side of each other. They're really not. 7, 9, 11, 13. You know, we have all the odd channels. And when it comes to upper VHF and lower VHF, we have the even channels. And that's because they knew that there was limited selectivity in the tuner front ends of television sets. So those adjacent channels are assigned to some other piece of geography. I wonder if the Metroplex or whoever it is that does the FM repeater assignments, allocations, coordinating, are they smart enough to look at geography when they look at the frequency assignments? So B2RYY, K2RIW.
15 miles apart if you're adjacent channel.
The fact that these two guys are only 7 miles apart sounds to me like they did not look at geography. Is that what you believe, Joe?
I can't totally say that for sure, but what I do know, it creates massive holes around your repeater. In commercial world, all the repeaters are receive high, transmit low. And all the channels can be 25 kc apart from each other, and everybody lives happily ever after. But not in the amateur world.
Do you think their motivation for doing this is that they think they can double the number of assignments? Is that what's going on?
No. What I understand what their thinking was, they're putting the burden on the repeater owner. But by putting another alternate channel flipped around the other way, somebody can listen to a distant repeater 25 kilohertz away as a, you know, as a user, and not have his radio get overloaded. That's what the thinking was behind it. They're not only doing this on UHF, they're doing it in some parts of the country on VHF. Now, can you imagine what you'd have for a problem if somebody went even 30 kilohertz away from you on 14682, if they wanted to put a repeater on 146.22 or 146.28 as an output, and they were like 15 miles away from your repeater in Glen Oaks. But when their repeater come up, it would desense your receiver. Do you think you'd be happy about that?
Yeah, it sounds like the concept has got a lot of problems. And I'd like to believe that these coordinating committees are going to slowly get smarter on how they do these assignments. Sounds like there's a better way to go. I think we've answered everyone who signed in tonight. We'll see. Rich, maybe, K2KNB, is going to tell us about an upcoming flea market, a hamorama. K2KMB, Mr. President, are you there?
Yes, I am, Dick. I figured you were just checking to see if I was really going to be here at this point. But one quick comment. It's MetroCorp that does the assignment, and what they did try to do was to tighten up the paperwork when you applied for computer cares. They do try to get information about your site, the height, the power, things like that, to get some idea of how far apart stations should be with the same frequency. But as far as the pairs go, I know we have similar problems on 900 megahertz that we're trying to work with, because we do come close to some of the commercial parts of the band, and the original assignment of our pairs hasn't really worked, and I think we're looking to reverse it. But it is a real problem. I'm surprised that 7 miles apart they've allowed something like that to exist. Anyway, June 1st, Briarcliff College or Stewart Avenue in Bethpage will be the next Flybar Ham Fest, and it's just about 2 months away. We've been trying to listen to people who, you know, have said that they really long for the old days when you go to a ham fest and there'd be tons of used equipment out there, and we're trying to work to that. We don't have a lot of control over it, but we have kind of introduced an early bird special, and the information will be up on the website, flymark.org. And basically, we'll offer a discount if you sign up, get your registration fee for May 15th. We'll offer you a discount. And get the bottom line, you have to remember that Weimar is a fundraising project, so if we keep the amount low, it doesn't hurt that bad, and maybe it'll give people an opportunity to really clean out their basement, clean out their shafts, and take a shot on coming down, and maybe we can kind of regenerate some of the old spirit of really wild and crazy outdoor ham fest with a lot of people there and a lot of product. So June 1st, starting 9 o'clock in the morning, Briarcliff College, Stewart Avenue, in Bethpage. Thanks, Mr. KCKS.
Very fine, Rich. I'm going to guess that the buyers come in at 9 o'clock, sellers come in at roughly 7 o'clock. Is that true?
Yeah, between 7 and 7:30. It's pretty simple when it's an outdoor setup. You have to remember to bring your own table, but it's a you're buying a parking space, so whatever you can fit into that space, you want to do it. But that's about it. 7:30 for sellers and 9 o'clock for buyers.
I think we've gone through the list of everyone who had questions. If not, give me your call letters right now if we skip somebody.
WW, with a comment and a question, comment on the last subject, Dick.
Go right ahead, Howie. Howie, you got to speak a little bit softer. You're sometimes jumping out of the repeater. Go ahead.
Just going to make a comment. Yeah, MetroCorp, that's a political thing. That goes back to the 1970s when they felt that mobile radio didn't have the selectivity. And it was a certain gentleman who was involved with the league that came up with that idea. And that creates a problem, Dick. I ran into a problem where I could not run a switching supply on my repeater system because if I ran a Samlex or a Doricom, I tried all kinds of filtering. I would create problems for repeaters 50 and 100 kcs away on odd frequencies, even if they were 10 and 12 or 20 miles away. I had to go back to a linear supply. If I ran a switching supply, I would raise the noise floor and detense people's receivers. That would not happen if we were all in the same direction.
There are switching supplies and there are switching supplies. So, Howie, if you take a look at the switching power supply, that's in the December issue of 1999 QST magazine, the one designed by Manfred Mohnenweg. Can't think of his, a man who lives in Chile, who works for the Southern European Observatory, European Southern Observatory. He had a power supply where you could take the 12-volt output, capacitively couple it into your receiver, scan from 160 meters to 30 meters, and not find anything to listen to. That was a quiet power supply. Switching type regulator, switching type power supply. 12-volt inverter, 12-volt to I think it was 120 volt output. So there are ways of making them quiet. I didn't say it's easy. Whenever you look at that particular schematic diagram, the average person says, gee, why is it so complicated? Why are there so many parts? Well, that's what's required to make a switching power supply that carefully controls the amount of drive to the push-pull transistors to make sure they're not being overdriven so that they come out of saturation on each half cycle just the right way. There's a whole lot of tricks to making a clean power supply. So of the switching type power supplies that were available to you, I can see how you would have a problem. Out of curiosity, you'll know that a friend of mine has recently run into a problem where in his particular environment, the fluorescent lights are running on what's called a solid-state ballast. Let me drop. The solid-state ballast runs at roughly 50 kilohertz. There are nearby transmitters and there are adjacent channels 50 kilohertz away. So what's happening is that a transmitter signal that's nearby to the fluorescent lighting, where there's a solid-state transformer running at 50 kilohertz switching rate, is generating side lobes that are 30 dB above threshold, 50 kilohertz away from the transmitter. So the adjacent channel, even if the transmitter is perfect, the adjacent channel is being interfered with by fluorescent lighting. So that happens. Fluorescent lighting is a kind of a mixture, a kind of a mixer. It's a plasma device, and it'll do a beautiful job of mixing if you give it the spiky voltages, and that's what the solid-state ballast will do for you. I think you said you've got another question, Howie, so go right ahead, and make sure you don't modulate too heavily. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Got a comment on power supply.
Question. Well, actually, two questions now you brought up. Dick, if you had to go out and buy a supply and money was no object, what would you buy? I'm not looking to build, you know. You know, Samlex was $500. I've tried $500, $600 supplies. So if you had to go out and get a real good supply that wouldn't give you a real headache, what would be the best one? And I have a question on, and I'll make a comment about fluorescent lights. I've seen problems like that. And I got a comment about power supplies and AM broadcast interference, actually. Something that I've noticed many years ago, Dick. So let me give it to you, and then Mel can go ahead with his comment.
Yeah, bear in mind, Howie, your audio is, again, quite heavy. So we're going to back off a little bit more. Go ahead, Mel.
I ran into a similar problem with power supplies and switching power supplies. Tried a variety of them, but in this case, it still was giving some problems because these people had extremely good ears, to say the least. I won't go into any more why and how, but let's put it this way. They were able to detect it better than I could. And BSF weight was not the problem. Went back to a power supply that I was able to obtain and use as a power transformer, back to the power transformer, instead of, the system of using the oscillated circuits in the 800 kilohertz or whatever they use, 100 to 300 kilohertz switching circuits that they're using in the lightweight, very compact power supply. But they're in a situation where the weight and size wasn't the problem. One with the old-fashioned power transformer, Dick, even though it was large, yes, and it was heavy, surely took care of the problem. Over.
I can see how that would work. If you're willing to spend the money and the size and the weight, a big transformer, big filter capacitors, and so on. Lots of people these days want everything to be compact, and so switching regulators are very popular. With good design, you can make these spikes coming out of a switching regulator as low as you like. You can bring them down to millivolts and microvolts and nanovolts if you work hard enough at it. Now, to answer your question, Howie, what power supply would I buy? I don't know. Haven't done that investigation recently. I don't know who makes a good one. I'd like to believe there's somebody out there that does. The next step would be for you to do a rather thorough investigation. Buy what you believe is a good one. Put it through the right kind of filter network a brute force line filter, study what's left over with a good oscilloscope, try to find out where in the switching regulator those spikes are being made, and step by step they can be lowered by X number of decibels. You'll never make them go to minus infinity in decibels, but it's possible. You can knock them down a lot of dBs if you figure out what the causative agent is and put in the right kind of filter networks and a shielding network and anti-ring circuits. And in the case of that power supply that's in the 1999 December issue of 1999 December issue and the January issue of 2000 of QSC Magazine, lead article is an extremely quiet, extremely high reliability switching power supply that takes 12 volts in and puts 120 volts out. I think that's what it did. I may have it wrong, but it was a switching power supply with extremely high reliability. What Manfred had done in that case, because he was supplying the power supplies for the repeaters that were located on the tops of the mountains in Chile where he lived.
I can tell you what it's all about there.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to you in a second, Mel. He's the guy that had to go to the mountaintop and repair them. So he had very strong motivation to give them extremely high reliability so that he'd have to go climbing to these mountaintops. Go ahead, Mel.
Yeah, I built one of his power supplies. Bit of a project. XQ2FOD, Manfred. He made that power supply at 110 in or 220 and 12 volts out, very clean. The ARRL lab tested that power supply as the only one of that switching power supply series that they ever gave a completely good, you know, 100% check to. The other ones, they reviewed all these power supplies that are now these switching supplies that are selling, you know, for amateur radio use, for 100-watt transceivers, you know, all these ones that they're coming out with now, you know, companies that are selling them, all the popular companies. Not one of them is perfectly clean across the spectrum. They vary in degrees of how good they are, but nothing approaches Manfred's one that he designed, his switching power supply for 12 volts. And continuous 35 amp stick over.
Yeah, do you remember, as I do, and maybe it was in the extra emails you can get from Manfred, you talked to Manfred directly, and he's got another couple of thousand words that they didn't have room to put into the article. And I believe the test that he ran was a capacitive coupling from the output of the power supply while it's running and while it's loaded into a good sensitive 80 to 10 meter receiver. And you scan all the way across 80 to 10 meters, and you could not find a signal out of that power supply. Do you remember that test, Mel? Go ahead.
Precisely. That's why I said it. 35 amps. That's what he did it at. He wanted a T-down 35 amp supply, and that was clean right across the spectrum. In fact, that's when the ARRL lab went ahead and built one to his specifications. Duplicated the same power supply and found that he was 100% correct there, Governor.
So there's your answer, Howie. That particular power supply, both tested by Manfred on top of the mountains and tested by the ARRL lab, that's a clean one. You can't buy it. It's going to take you a month of Sundays to build it. In fact, the main switching power supply transformer that's in there is not even a commercial product. Because he's in the outback of the world, you can't just go down to Santiago, Chile, and walk into a Radio Shack and buy a switching transformer. He had to choose some available cores and epoxy them together in order to make a bigger core. He had to almost make his own parts. Over to you, Howie, K2RIW.
Somebody will come out with a power supply like that. Okay, here's the next comment or question. Many years ago, I owned a Sony 2010, which was a Sony shortwave receiver. This receiver was a battery operated, and it all came with an adapter. If you use any other adapter, except the adapter that it came with, you would hear a buzz, like 120 cycle buzz or a 60 cycle buzz. And I called the manufacturer and said, why is it? It doesn't matter what supply I hooked up. When you look at the schematic of their supply, they had caps, certain type of caps, you know, 0.001 across each dial. That supply, if you didn't use the right supply, because of the way the, you know, the bridge rectifier worked, it would actually... Have you ever heard of something like that, Dick? Where if you didn't use the exact supply that the manufacturer wanted, you would hear a buzzing, and it was because the AC power line was the other side of the antenna system?
I can tell you a funny story, too, about that when I have it here, Dick.
Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, I bought the 2010 when it came out. It's a terrific portable receiver. I'm in fact looking right at it now. I use it to copy CW practice on W1AW. The battery supply was 3D batteries in there. That's the primary, and then a couple of AA batteries that are your backup for your backup system in there, memory. If the voltage, this is a strange. When the, as the batteries, I noticed, if the batteries, the D batteries, start to get a little weak, I started to hear like funny sort of distortion in it. And couldn't imagine what that was. And that, it was very voltage sensitive. So the adapter that you have to get for that thing is a 3.5 volt adapter, and it's got to be precise. There is no room for either way with that thing. Go a little higher with the voltage, no good. Go a little lower, it's no good. It's got to be exact. In other words, you've got to duplicate 3D batteries. And I even tried rechargeable batteries. Oh, I had that idea. I got 3 D-size rechargeable batteries. Would you believe it wouldn't work, Dick?
Because your D-size rechargeable batteries were NiCad. And very soon after they're charged and you're in the discharge cycle, they go down to 1.2 volts. And this thing wants 1.5 volts on each cell. That's a guess on my part. I've run into a similar problem with the Kenwood TR-751, a 2-meter, all-mode, very nice rig, mobile type. However, I've got one in my car, and when I run it on the cigarette lighter, even in the low-power mode, if the engine is not running, and if I'm not putting out 13 and a fraction volts, the thing is unhappy. Very unhappy in the sideband mode, even unhappy in the FM mode. In other words, they put no leeway into the voltage regulators inside. It's got to have 12.1 volts or above coming into the back panel of the rig, or it goes haywire. The phase lock loop starts dropping out. So, had they done a real good job, they would have designed a rig where the internal voltages for all the vital circuits, like the phase lock loop and early signal generators, are really regulating down to, say, 8 volts. There's nothing magic about running them at 12. They could run very nicely at 8. But they made a 12-volt design. And you go below 12.1 volts, those regulators start starving out, and pretty soon any glitches on your power supply come roaring through that rig. So it's a design phenomenon. That's what I think you're running into with that Sony. Back to you, Howard, turn in the comments, and speak a little bit softer. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, that is true, but this particular power supply, even if you got exactly the right voltage, the way the bridge was set up and the way it was connected, using it as part of the antenna system, because the dials in most power supplies would be on and off, it would actually modulate the signal. Seth, let me ask Mel a question. Mel, you got to be careful with that radio. I lost one radio. I dropped it off my pit. Where those little double A's go, it's very delicate. If that breaks, you're in trouble. That radio is an excellent radio, but it's very delicate. Right there, Mel?
Yeah, well, of course it's delicate. Of course it'll break in pieces. But, you know, the case and everything on these radios wasn't high impact on the inside. It wasn't built for heavy use. It's a nice radio. It's just in one spot here. Hardly has been moved in a long, long time. And it's just a nice shortwave radio with FM. and the aircraft, and that's all I use it for. I have it in the kitchen, a corner of the kitchen here, and what it's convenient for, because at times I just want to listen, like the W1AW, pick up, keep my CW coat practice up to par. So I never used it on really as an AM radio or broadcast or anything. Strictly use it as a shortwave radio, Howie, over.
But it has a great synchronous detector, and believe it or not, it actually has upper and lower sideband, and it goes to 100 cycles. That was a great radio. I took, when I traveled in Europe, lived in Europe for several months, I had that radio. That's a beautiful radio. I'd like to get another one. They don't make it anymore. I don't think any of the newer radios, Mel, come close to that radio. That front end was very hot. Just don't hook it up to an outside antenna or you will pop the front end. The transistors were pretty sensitive. Other than that, that radio with that little whip antenna, that thing worked perfectly. I was in Greece and I was in Romania and we used to be able to listen to the amateur band. That was a great radio. Had great synchronous detection. I'd like to get another one of those one of these days. Back to you, Mel.
That radio, WS2N.
Hiya, Paul. Yeah, like I say, it happens to be an unusual piece of equipment. Had a, you know, a radio of this type, or basically made for shortwave listeners. You never expected a quality of a radio like this to work extremely. Like you say, with just the whip antenna, and one that has lower sideband, upper sideband, and sounds so good on CW and all. So, okay, great radio. Has a lot of nice little buttons there, you know, direct the pad on it to direct the route to the frequency and the memories and, you know, all those good little gadgets. And, you know, it's going back a good number of years. Too bad they went out of production on it. All right, Dick, go ahead.
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Just a quick comment about what Howie was talking about before, about finding a power supply that's good for RF applications that doesn't have a lot of noise. There are standards in switching power supplies that for radiated and conducted emissions, and there is the rating I would suggest to look for on the marking power supply would be for FCC Class B compliance. Usually a power supply that meets that compliance level usually will. It's a hard thing to find, but it is something at least you could look for as a guide. KC2QIQ, back up to you, Jeff.
Sounds like a good thing to know about. Class B FCC specification. Paul, I hear tell that the astronomy people were quite happy over the last couple of days because the flyby of the AVC and the International Space Station flew over our territory, I think it was last night, at sundown, and there were people who said they saw a very nice bright light in the sky as it swept by. WS2N, K2LAW in the TechNet.
I missed that. I didn't know about that, Dick. Very good. I wanted to comment about the Sony 2010 that Mel bought. You know, that radio is great. Well, I think Howie brought it up, but when I was first learning back in mid-80s, Ralph NS2S, I think you might remember him, Dick. He was involved with the Peconic Club out east. I think you spoke out there one time. He had lent me that radio to learn CW on, and I thought that was the greatest little radio going. You know, I kept that the whole time until I got my ticket, and then I selectivity and everything, especially like Mel says with CW. If you can get another one of those, maybe, you know, I'm sure they're on eBay. They're very good radios. I don't know about the power supply being exact or whatever, but, you know, I know it operated either battery or you plug it in and single sideband and all, and I cannot believe the selectivity of it. I liked it better than my Kenwood 440 as a receiver for CW. Unbelievable. Back to you there, Dick.
Sounds like a fun radio. If they're being resold, even though it's out of production on eBay, what's your guess as to what kind of prices they're going for, Paul? Go ahead.
Back then, I think they were, what,
Mel probably remembers. I think they were in a deep range, right? Something like that. So, I don't know. Mel probably remembers. I'm sure back to Dick.
Yeah, we had a little bit of a drop out. What kind of price do you think they're selling for, Mel?
Oh, gee, I wouldn't venture a guess. They were very reasonably priced when it came out. Extremely reasonably priced. Under $200, I think it was like $175 or something. I got it from HRO. That's where I bought it from. HRO in Delaware, and they went fast. You know, once the once the number of amateur shortwave listeners and all, whoever was able to get their hands or listen to one, just as Paul said, they ran out and bought them, and Sony just dropped it from the line. I don't know why, but they just let it go, and it has a very nice thing like a tuning. Your master tuning mode. They have a slow and fast on the tuning mode. That's really great. In other words, you can actually, so when you turn the tuning off, it actually gives you a different rate of tuning, Dick. So if you want to go across the band fast, you can put it to the fast mode, even though you're doing it mechanically, and vice versa. So, it's got a lot of nice things. Lights in there, I can say. It's got the aircraft band, it's got the FM, AM band, direct, which are on direct buttons. So, have a lot of features on it that really is one heck of a radio. I'm happy to have it. I'm going to hang on to it, I guess, forever and over.
I presume it runs on 3 internal D-size batteries, I think you said, and it also has a power supply. You can run it from the 110-volt line. But you got to use their exact power supply. Is that the way it works, Mel?
Yeah, Roger. On the side, on the left side, they got a whole bunch of little plug switches and things. You can have DX local here. It has a tone control, low, high in the tone, and earphone connection, and the power supply plug with the power supply in there. And the power supply, yeah, it's a little World War power supply that they came up with for us. I have to have that power supply. It did go bad on me once, believe it or not. Did I have a problem with that wire. For some reason, they have a internal fuse right on the big C there. It's just a whisker, one of these little whiskers. And it opened up, and I had, unfortunately, crack the World War apart. But there is a way, you know, you can crack it a certain way in a vise, in a wood vise. And that way you, really don't do any damage. It just opens up like a walnut that just snaps apart. And that you can put it back together. But that was the only problem I ever had with it, Dick, over.
I think you said it runs on 3 D-size batteries. Delta, Dog type. If so, at reasonable audio volume, or is it 3 C-cells? I'm amazed that it runs on something that big. What you guess is how long it runs on, say, 3 brand new alkaline batteries.
Oh boy, you put 3 good D batteries in this thing, and it's going to go, I think, almost, well, playing it, you know, running it at normal volume and all, and not blasting things away that you don't destroy the speaker or something, but it's got quite a bit of volume. But in normal use and all, the thing almost, hey, if you've got those good potent batteries, they'll go for at least a year or more of normal use every day. It's amazing. It's really well-designed, unusually well-designed, everything, the ergonomics, everything on it. And, where do you find a radio like this with a 3D battery? It's, I guess, say, unusual, Dick, over.
Sure is. But it fulfills a certain requirement. There are people who just love these laptop computers, and take a look at the one that's really skinny these days. I think it's called the MacBook Air or something like that. The thing starts off, I believe it's 125 thousandths of an inch thick at the forward edge, and something like 750 thousandths of an inch thick at the back edge. This is a laptop computer with a large screen. Wow. how much battery is in there. I think there are people who claim that you can run the thing on an airline, for instance, for 2 hours, but then the battery goes dead. And so that's a little bit of an annoyance to me. If you were writing a memo or a report, you're on an airliner for 4 hours and you're writing a report and your battery goes dead in 2.5 hours, and very few people carry a spare battery for their laptop computer, they're not that easy to change. So batteries are a problem. And when it comes to cell phones, everybody wants the cell phone to be smaller and smaller and smaller. And not many people are smart enough to carry a spare battery for their cell phone. It seems like a fair number of people are complaining about the fact that, I've got to charge my cell phone every day. And after a year of that, of charging it and discharging it every single day, the battery doesn't hold charge anymore. Now I've got to buy a new one. They usually buy a new cell phone. They blame it on the whole cell phone, not on just the battery, which, in my opinion, should be a replaceable item. I know that when I go to things like the New York City Marathon, and I was doing some radio communication work with that crew quite a few years ago, I would carry spare batteries in my pocket for my handy talkie with a chunk of plastic across the top of it to make sure that my keys or change wouldn't be shorting out the battery. The last thing you want is a NiCad battery in your pocket that's in the short circuit mode. That's going to get you in a place where it's going to hurt. Mel, did we get any mail this week? And what should we be discussing according to that mail? And before I turn it over to you, let's double check with Paul. Is there anything that you think you should be reporting to us, Paul, as to what's going on in space? WS2N, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Dick, I have a question for you about space, W2EWK, for Cricky.
Okay, let me first find out if Paul's available. Go ahead, Paul.
1 second, Dick. It'll give me about 10 minutes. I'm on my HCL. Give me about 10 minutes, Dick.
Okay, we'll give you 10 minutes. Eugene, you got it.
Okay, Dick, I was just about to sneeze, and the sneeze wants to come out. Now I think it stopped. Okay, when the space shuttle landed, there was fire coming out of the tail end of the spaceship. And someone told me that is a exhaust system for the spaceship. So give me a little information on that, Dick. I'll be listening to you. W2EWK.
Yeah, one of the strange things about all airliners, and particularly true of the space shuttle, is that the wheels are not spun up before they land. So the space shuttle, I think, lands at something like 240 miles an hour. And those poor, great big wheels on that space shuttle suddenly touch the ground with, 100 tons of weight. The aircraft is moving at 240 miles an hour, and the ground ain't moving at all. So those poor wheels have to slide against that concrete until they finally spin up to speed. So you always get smoke coming out of those tires at the instant of touchdown. That smoke you see coming out of the back of the space shuttle on landing when you're looking at one of the rear cameras that's on the runway is because of the wheels touching down. Yes, there are some extra gases being vented from the fuel tanks on board, but that's a very slow venting. You wouldn't see that. And as soon as it rolls to a stop, they do hook up all kinds of machinery to make sure that they drain all of those tanks, because some of them contain slightly toxic substances. But that smoke you see on landing is the tires spinning up. Lots of people have proposed ways of spinning the tires before you land to try to save rubber. But the big problem with that is you've always got a brake somewhere that's dragging. So if one wheel had a dragging brake, and that wheel didn't spin, and the other wheels did spin, now with the instant of touchdown, you'd be getting more traction on one side than the other, and the aircraft would be put into what they call a ground loop. It would start running sideways, and that could collapse the landing gear. So rather than run into that possible risk, they just say, what the heck, we'll just simply recap the tires periodically and let it burn up rubber when it touches the runway. I'm back to you, Eugene. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay. No. I was not talking about the Rio. I was talking about the exhaust system. When it landed, you can see, you know, flames coming out of the exhaust system. Back to your deck, W2WK.
I doubt that highly. That space shuttle does not use its rocket engine on landing. You see a lot of smoke coming off those wheels, and because of the aerodynamics, the smoke gets whipped up behind what looks like it's coming out of the exhaust ports of the engine, of the jet engine, the rocket engine. It looks like it's coming from there. It's coming from the wheels. On top of that, as soon as they touch down a couple of seconds, they deploy a parachute. So you see a parachute swinging back and forth behind the space shuttle, and you see the smoke coming off the wheels that comes up off, and it looks like it's coming out of the rocket engine. I don't think you saw any flames coming out of those rocket engines. Anyone else got any comment on that one? Give me a call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, this was a strange landing this time. It was an evening flight. They were saying that there were only a certain number of these, and things that were normally not visible on these landings were visible on this one in particular. And the flame that Howie saw is the same flame that I saw, and it really wasn't coming from the engines exactly. It was towards the tail half of the shuttle, and it was actually just before the wing section in the back. It was like a vent. It almost looked like a small propane fire coming out the back. And I think everybody was watching TV at the time, including the announcer, was a little surprised at it. And I recall one of the announcers saying something that it was something to do with one of the life support systems that's operating on the shuttle, that it actually does exhaust just in front of the rear tail section, and it's only visible in the evening landing.
How about you, ask Glenn?
Yeah, there's also the power assist module. What are they called, Paul? Go ahead.
There is venting coming off of that, and being a night landing, they usually show that in infrared. I wonder if they saw that in the infrared. And it looks more dramatic at night. It was a 20-second night landing that they had. Only one out of five flights have landed at night. So you don't get to see that often, but this constant venting that's coming off, usually the top of the shuttle, you'll see it coming off of life support. They're always getting rid of heat. Inside of that shuttle is very hot. Inside of the space station is very hot. That's why they have these gigantic radiators on the space station. You see the solar panels, but you also see the radiators, constant heat from inside the cabin. It's well insulated inside the shuttle between space and inside, and the heat really builds up. So it's a constant. It's constantly venting, even in space. In fact,
I can't think of the right name, but what do they call those power assist modules? I think there's three of them, which are really a kind of a small jet engine that is powering a hydraulic system that moves the control surfaces. I'm calling them power assist modules. I think there's a more technical name for them. Go ahead.
The APUs that they're talking about there?
That's them, auxiliary power units. The auxiliary power units are small jet engines running on the fuel that's in the tank. And those being vented would look like a flame at nighttime. I wonder what you think about that one, Paul.
Oh, definitely. And they're also, they run them on the hydrazine fuel as well. So, definitely. And they need that. They need them up and running before they land. In space, of course, you don't need your Avalons or elevators or anything, but once you enter the atmosphere, you do. So they have three on board. It takes one to operate the hydraulics to land, but there's actually three. Everything has redundancy. Well, this has a triple set of APUs that run if they take off and they have two APUs running and they're flying, they'll continue on. But if that other one fails, that would be an abort. They would abort to Spain, to Madrid, or even come back to Kennedy if they if they had, you know, if they're not too far up, I could go.
Okay, auxiliary power units. And those are small jet engines, I think, producing all kinds of kilowatts of power for running all the hydraulics, among other things.